So this has been like one mighty wild ride. And I'm so excited to be up here tonight. So it's, you know, we had this pandemic happening and I heard our speaker speak on a Zoom meeting and I was like, like, I need to get this woman to send in a speaker tape for our committee. And I just threw it in the bunch, and my committee listened to everyone, and they picked her. And so we're bringing you Charity tonight. Thank you.
Hi, y'all. I'm Charity.
Hi. And I'm
Charity. We love you.
Times tonight, and I'm not a crier. My grandfather likes to tell me that it's the ice on my soul melting. So I guess I still have some ice to melt. The grace of a power greater than myself has kept me from a drink since June 26, 2000. And that was a miracle. And I'm as grateful as I know how to be about that today. When I speak, I always read out of page 124 in the family afterword. And what it says is Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is the only one. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring more mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession that you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. And that's why I'm here tonight, and that's why I repeat that to remind me when I'm here. I'm here to share my experience. Experience is what I have. I have this book, I have this literature, and I have my experience. And I'm just, I've never done this at a conference like this size, so I'm extremely nervous. Give me a minute and I'll get into this and I'll be fine. But I have to. He's not about you, Nikki. Okay? It's not about you. You pray. You ask God to direct you. You're speaking. So it's no longer any of your business. None of your business is one of our favorite races. It's one of mine, too. My sponsors hate it. They hate it. But none of my business. So to tell my story, I'm going to tell you that there are some outside issues that have come up. Just because if I don't tell you who I was and what I've dealt with, you won't know what God's done for me. So anything that's outside of the book is my experience and my experience only. A disclaimer in the beginning for that. Okay, so I was born in Galveston, Texas. And I know the The schedule said that I'm from Chicago, and I live near Chicago now, but only for the last 11 months. As you can't tell, I'm not from there. I'm from Texas. I was born in Galveston and lived about an hour from there, grew up there. I had a mom, my dad, and a little sister, an older sister who lived with her mom, who was my dad's first wife. And it's hard because the hardest part of my story is the beginning. I always have to go into the painful past for this. And the painful past is my dad was an alcoholic in the end. And not a nice one. Not a nice one. I have to keep it real, right? Like, I know my childhood wasn't like the worst ever. It also wasn't good. It was bad. He was violent. There was every form of abuse. We never knew what was going to happen. We never knew what I wanted to do or what was. I had to relearn what's going to happen, what's going on. And I learned to relearn this, and I learned to review, and then try to get through what you want to stay sick. So there were things like sneaking out of the window in the middle of the night with my mom to avoid a tirade, you know. Jails, institutions, psych wards, and death. That's where my heart took. And we saw a lot of it. Lots of jails, institutions, psych wards, and finally death. There were death threats, there were suicide attempts, it was all the stuff. You know the stuff. You've seen the stuff. And then, you know, I'd always had this intrinsic idea somewhere in me that there was something out there. I did. I always had that feeling that there was something out there. But at about 4 or 5, that's when my dad started speaking into my room and mind. And I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed. And nothing changed. Nothing happened. No one saved me. And I decided at that point that God could basically go screw himself. And that I was on my own. I had to be self-reliant and do everything by myself because no one was going to do it for me. So that was what it was. You know, I started escaping as soon as I could. I started by reading books. That was my first escape. And then I was food. And I don't remember how far back that goes. And then I was self-harm. And then there were guys. And then I found out in hall at 14. And my older sister had already been through rehab in high school. And when she graduated, she came down to live with us and near us. And I even went to AA meetings, open AA meetings with her because she was trying to be sober. And I remember in those meetings, I hadn't had a job yet, but I related. I related to those people who already felt like home. I was only 13 years old. But a few months later, she came to me and she said, "Hey, Jillian, you know what? It's just drugs. The drugs are bad. The drugs are so bad. And as long as I just drink, you'll be okay." And I ordered her up, you know. And it never occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to control it. It never occurred to me that from the beginning I would be an alcoholic. I thought it was about willpower, and I didn't understand. Didn't understand. Sorry. You're very kind. I've been just a derail for a second all weekend. I feel like the old person at the young person's convention, and I'm like, "Ooh, that's such a nice young lady, such a nice young man." Age. Okay, make sure I don't fall. I am in heels for the first time in like 3 years. That's what I was talking about. Anyway, so 14, and my sister was like, "Okay, we're gonna drink." It was absolutely magical. Anything I wanted to be or not. made oblivion possible. You know, the possible was natural, but during as much as I could, as often as I could. My story, my sister, who got in a fight, went outside of the Indian store, they had me. I was 15 years old, boys got called, it was a thing. You know, those things. So that ended my drinking with my sister. But there was drinking with friends, there was, you know, all the things that I did. So then, 2 days before I graduated high school, my father tried to train my mother, and she decided she had me. And she left. And that sounds like a horrible thing, but it was actually one of the happiest days of my life. Because I thought, okay, my sister is safe now. I was 18, I was about to leave and go to Austin to go to school. And I wanted my sister to be safe. And I thought she would be. And so I was excited. I've been trying to get my mother going for years. So I was very excited. So I went to Austin. Yes, that's right. Open. I even have a tattoo. Kind of a nut. And I thought that it was going to be glorious. I was leaving all that shit behind. I was not going to have to deal with them anymore. Like, things were going to be glorious. Here's the thing. I was still there. I still went with me. And geographical thing doesn't work. It didn't work for me. It didn't work for me at all. It was as much as I could drink. And it's so funny. I'm like the overachieving perfectionist alcoholic. So yeah, there are some of us. And a few of us. I was the worst semester of drinking, I would get the best grades. Because it helped me function. It was a solution. It helped me survive until it didn't. So I did all the things, you know, that we try to control it. Because I was the type that was always more or less insanely drunk. I didn't black out that first time I drank, but the second time I drank, I did. And almost every single time after that. And I had no idea that other people didn't. I just assumed that was part of the gig. So I just kept on blacking out. And I did, you know, I did all of the things that we do when we're drinking. I made an ass of myself. I said nasty things. I was a crier when I was drunk, actually. Not when I'm sober, but when I was drunk, I would cry. And it was pathetic. It was really bad. And I would embarrass myself. Or I'd be on the table dancing. Like, it was, I never knew when I picked up a drink, except for passing out, what else was going to happen. So I tried to control it, and I tried limiting the number of drinks, drinking only out didn't really work because I like to drink before and get started ahead of time. I wanted to be ahead of you. I was a liquor drinker. Like, if you had beer or wine and it was free, cool. If you wanted any of mine, no. Not sharing. And I wanted whiskey, tequila, or pretty much that was, whatever. That was my drink of choice. I had a sipping bottle in my college door. Like, it was so ridiculous. Oh, sorry, speak up. I got away. It gets too loud and then it gets too soft. Anyway, I had that sipping bottle of tequila for college. I tried letting boyfriend count drinks. That did not go well because I did not like that. Because then I was just sneaking drinks anyway. Like, what difference did it make? Then there were fights. You know, I tried, if I eat before I go, if I do this, I always had a new idea for how I was going to control it. But I never did. And I got tired of what would happen when I drank out. So I stopped drinking out early. By the time I was 21, I wasn't drinking out anymore because it always ended badly for me. Maybe not like terrible consequences, like I didn't go to jail necessarily, but I had hurt people. I hurt people. And I hurt me. And that was enough. So I started drinking. You know, I actually graduated in 3 years with like a fairly high GPA, right? Just that overachieving thing. And I got lost. I definitely got lost. That's right, I am. And this is one of those moments where I'm like, oh crap. Human, I'm human. Okay, so I got a job. I started drinking at home. I thought it was the most brilliant plan ever made by a person because it was cheaper. I could pass out wherever I wanted. I left the alarm clock in the bedroom and in the living room so that I would wake up for work. And that was how I drank the last 2 years I drank. That was it. So I still didn't realize I was an alcoholic. I had this list of reasons why I wasn't. Like, I didn't look like my dad did. I didn't look like my sister did. I didn't look like my uncle did. Like, my family on both sides, pretty much in family reunions, we have the side that is currently alcoholic and the side that is in AA. And we have meetings in reunions because we can. I'm going in a couple of weeks and we'll probably have a meeting or go to one, a bunch of us. So I have a long line. And I knew that something needed to stop, but I thought if I took care of all those childhood wounds and the trauma, that I would start to be able to drink like other people. I thought that was the answer. So I was trying not to drink. Sometimes I could put time between drinks, but not always. And I was really, really trying. I was white knuckling it for about 3 months. I was about to turn 23. My dad was 46 at that point, so twice my age. And now at 45, that does not sound like old, but it did then. And I thought he was the most miserable human being I'd ever known. And at 23, he overdosed. And it shook something in me that I didn't want to live the next 23 years of my life like he did. And that was if I was lucky and I died young, because I wasn't scared of dying. I was scared of living those 23 years like that. And that was if I died at 46. So something had to change. You know, there were a lot of other things going on in my life. I was about to leave a very, very codependent relationship. One where we lived together for a year, separated for a year, lived together for a year, you know, the back and forth thing. And so that was happening. I didn't know it yet, but I was having clinical depression. A bunch of things were happening. My dad had just overdosed. It brought up all kinds of feelings, lots of feelings. And I got to a point where I knew I couldn't live without it anymore, but I couldn't live with it either. I got to that jumping off place. And I did something I hadn't done in 20 years, I prayed. I did that alcoholic prayer, that please God help me, I can't do this. And that's what I said. And that was June 26, 2000. And that's why I count that as my sobriety date, because that was the day I surrendered. It wasn't the day I was released from alcohol, but it was the day I surrendered. And 2 days later, I'm surfing on the interwebs, which were kind of new then. And I was looking at Al-Anon and adult children stuff, because my aunt had told me all about it and how much it helped her. And I'm still thinking, you know, if I get my shit together, then I can drink with other people. So I somehow got on an AA website and I was just, you know, looking around. They have those tests on there. You know, the ones where you take them. And because I'm kind of a nerd and I like personality, I know they're silly, right? But I love personality quizzes and all that kind of fun stuff. So I took one and I didn't know I was an alcoholic, so I was honest. I was honest. And I got to the bottom and it said, you've got a problem. You did really well. This is not the test you wanted to do really well on, but you did. And I was like, bullshit. Everybody's an alcoholic then. Everybody. Apparently not. My boyfriend took it later that day and he didn't do as well as I did.
There were four tests on there, four different ones. I don't know why they had four different ones, but they did for me. And I took all four of them because I needed to be sure. I really needed to be sure. I wasn't. But I got to the bottom of that fourth one. And something happened to me. And I had this moment to clarity. And it was literally like I watched my drinking career pass before my eyes. And I knew to the depth of my soul, as clearly as I know my own name, that I was alcoholic. And it took me 2 days to figure out that was the answer to the prayer. And it took me a couple more days to call my uncle, who I knew had been sober basically since I was born. So I thought a long time at that point, you know, 20 whatever years. And he had lived his life in a way where it was attraction rather than promotion. He lived his life in a way where I knew that he had an answer. And I called him. And after about 3 hours, because my family can talk, you wouldn't know it by me, sometimes my family can talk. Irish, you know, talks. So that's what we do when we talk or fight. But took me 3 hours and finally I said, I think I have a problem. And he said, oh, wow, okay. He said, well, usually people don't think that if they don't have a problem. Okay. He said, go to AA. He's like, that's the answer for you. I think, you know, he said, go try a bunch of different meetings. He said, go find a place where you vibe. Go find a place where you feel comfortable. So it took me a few more days to get up the courage to go to a meeting. I went to a meeting and I came home. There were meetings from page 21 and there's a solution in the big book that night. And I remember a little bit. I stayed afterwards. And you know, I was 23 and I got kind of dressed up to go because, you know, I didn't know. I thought, you know, I wanted to make my best presentation. So I dressed up and they thought I was there for like a school project. I'm like, yeah, no, dude, I've done that already. Thanks. And I was scared they were going to tell me that I hadn't drank enough or that I was too young because I was 23. But they didn't. And what they did instead was they gave me a big book, which I read in the next 2 days and looked through the stories just to see if I could find somebody else like me. And I found me all over the pages of that book. And they also sent me to a young person's group the next night. And that was my first home group, was a young people's meeting. And it was amazing. We could still have fun. But they were deadly serious. They were not playing. There were some thumpers, like some serious big book thumpers. So they didn't play. They're like, get a sponsor, do this, do this, do this. Okay. I got a sponsor a few days later. Okay, and here's how I am. I had a list of all the things that I thought my sponsor needed to have and be. She needed to qualify to sponsor me. She needed to qualify. Qualify. But what God did instead was he gave me exactly what I needed and what I would still need 22 years later. She's still my sponsor. And that's an amazing blessing. My sponsor is a blessing. She showed me how to do it. She didn't tell me. She said, walk the way I walk. Walk the way I walk. And I tried. And we went through the book, word by word. And we went through the steps. And one night was just a few weeks in, and I was at a meeting on Saturday night. They're like, hey, Cherry, we're having this group conscience after the meeting. You should stay. It's really fun. And I didn't know any better, so I stayed. And they gave me a literature commitment. I'm like 5 or 6 weeks over. And that meant I had to go learn about integrity. So that was a good thing. And then a couple of weeks later, they're like, hey, here's the key. We want you to open up on Wednesday nights. And I did that for the next couple of years. Every Wednesday night, Well, I was there Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday night, and then at other places, other nights, because I had no life, I had no friends, I had no anything. One night I was sitting in a meeting, and I was really, really shocked. Like, I really was. And there was a girl, and she looked really cool, and she had this eyebrow piercing. And anyway, I was like, oh, she looks so cool, and she got my number. But I would have never called her, right? I just wouldn't have. And she called me. And, you know, she wound up being the maid of honor at my wedding. I was the matron of honor at her wedding. I talked to her on Monday. She was telling me about her kids are doing, because she's still sober, too. And I have so many relationships from back then, and so many people that stayed sober, all because of the young person's group. And I'm so grateful that they taught me. I remember the first conference I went to was Texaco, and I was about 3 months sober. And we were you know, running it in Austin that year. And so everybody had to sign up and do stuff. I worked the coffee bar. Somebody had to teach me how to make coffee because I didn't drink it. I know that's very weird. Now I'll have to get us and drink coffee, but I didn't. So then I drank coffee that night, and a lot of it. And I didn't sleep for a couple of days, but that can happen anyway. So I'm one of those. But I remember that night really clearly because it was the first night I laughed so hard that I cried tears. I couldn't stop. I almost hyperventilated laughing. And I found out there was joy in Alcoholics Anonymous and in sobriety. And that was a beautiful thing. Dances. Okay. So I went to every dance that was in the county, every single one. And I remember when I was 13 and going to meetings with my sister, and I went to with her to a white ball dance at 13. And I was so scared that I didn't get up and dance. And then when I got sober, I was like, screw that, I'm dancing. Like, I'm dancing. We're going to do this. So we did. And, you know, stayed up. We had a crew, basically, and we spent every night together because we had nothing else to do. We did all of those things. I, like I said, I was taken through the steps by my sponsor, and did that fairly quickly in a few months, and then I was sponsoring people at like 5 or 6 months over because they said, okay, you've done it, now go. Go forth, young one. And I'm so silly. I wanted to be so wise and so profound. And even tonight, like, I want to change lives. Right? I want to change lives. And I might, but it's none of my business. And I don't need to know because my ego doesn't need me. But I did. I wanted to change lives, so I started sponsoring. And when I first started calling my sponsor, every time I talked to her, she would say, thank you for calling me. And I didn't understand. I'm like, woman, I just called you to bitch and moan and like whatever. And you're thanking me? But I learned why she thanked me. I learned why. And I've got to sponsor, I don't know how many people over the years. And every time it's a joy. Every time it's a joy. To watch that light come on, to watch lives change, to watch God work in their lives. There's something so magical about that. I found magic. The magic I found in alcohol, I found in the 12 steps. Yeah. It brought me to a relationship with a higher power that I could call on at any time. And I was never alone. Literally and, you know, figuratively, because we did pretty much spend 24 hours a day together. All of us, the group, because we had nowhere else to go. I even did things like bowling. I freaking hated, but I would go because that's what we were doing. Get in the car. Get in the car. I love story right now. Because sometimes I need to be told that today. I need to be told, get in the car. Stop it. Get in the car. So, when I was about 6 months sober, I started going through a depression. I didn't know that's what it was. Luckily, my sponsor did. She sent me for outside help. And I cannot recommend, if you need it, get outside help for whatever it is. Get the help you need. I needed a lot of help. I needed a psychiatrist, and I also needed a therapist. Because when I was going through the steps, when I got to the fourth step and I couldn't figure out who I was even angry at, I needed therapy to tell me who I was angry at so that I could even complete the steps. So for me, it was just an extension of the steps. It was a tool that would be in my tool belt. It was just a tool. And I recommend it for anybody who wants to grow, you know, in a direction, a new direction. I also started having flashbacks and nightmares. And they were bad. The first 2 years I was sober, quite honestly, I don't know how I did it because it was every day. And I had to quit my job. I had to go to therapy 2 or 3 times a week. I was in the doctor's office. But I did it. And AA helped me get through it. The people that I found here, the love that I found here, the answer that a higher power that I found here helped me get through that. And I haven't had a night, well, I have nightmares occasionally, but I haven't had a flashback in 20 years. Yeah. So things can heal. I don't know that am I ever healed all the way? I don't know. But I'm a whole hell of a lot better than I was when I started. And that's what I ask for, you know, each day to get a little bit better. Or maybe even each week, like some days I might backslide a little bit. You know, human. So a couple more years go by. I'm doing really well at that point. I'm happy. Things are good. Let me tell this the right way. Okay, so my picker is broke. broke. And I figured that out. And I'm like, okay, so how do I do this? And so what I did was I said a prayer to my higher power and said, okay, your turn. Because I can't pick, clearly. And I met this man. We were friends. And started just kind of talking. And then we went to a conference in San Antonio. We were in different groups or whatever. But we wound up hanging out together that day. And we actually went to the Al-Anon speaker, which I need to talk about in a minute. But we went to the Al-Anon speaker. And he laughed at all the right places. And I was like, wow, okay. That night, we went dancing for our first date. Because dancing, right? And we've been together ever since. We got married a little over a year later. We've been married for 17 years now. Mostly, or at least on my side, so I can't speak for him. I've learned with our dueling Al-Anons that I have to stay out of his program. He has to stay out of mine. I want to talk about Al-Anon for a second. When I was a couple years sober, I had a family member who was dying, basically. Like, she was hurting. It was hurting. And I couldn't watch it. So my sponsor, who had come in through Al-Anon, sent me to Al-Anon. And I found help in another 12-step fellowship. And I found an answer to for me to deal with people, for me to learn about being powerless over people, places, and things, and how to deal with that. And that affected my recovery. Because how could I be an effective sponsor? How could I be an effective partner? How could I be an effective friend? And Al-Anon taught me that. So I had a sober wedding. Everybody there, except for the best man and my mother's husband, were sober. And they went outside, I think, and smoked the joint in the back, but whatever. The best man did get sober a few years later. So attraction rather than promotion, right? But we had a sober wedding. And my grand sponsor, my sponsor, a woman I sponsored, a woman she sponsored, a woman she sponsored, were all there. Community. I find community in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a woman here tonight who came all the way from Texas just to be with me this weekend. suit up and we show up. We suit up and we show up. About 5 or 6 years into sobriety, I had to check myself into a psych ward because I was, the meds were not working for me, and I needed to go get help, and I did. And I had visitors every night. I had visitors every night. Nobody else had visitors. And they were all people from Alcoholics Anonymous. They were all people there. And then about 8 years sober, I was 31. And right about this time of year, actually, tomorrow it'll be 14 years ago that I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. And it came from a virus. It was random. I got bronchitis. The next week, I couldn't breathe. The next week, I was in the hospital, and they were telling me, yeah, you have congestive heart failure. And we don't know, you know, we're going to put you on meds. We'll do a few things. We'll see what happens. I wound up having to quit work. I couldn't work. I was sleeping 18 to 20 hours a day. And I got sicker and sicker until I was on the heart transplant list for about 18 months. And the doctor came to me and he said, you know, this other doctor wants to try this thing. They want to put a pacemaker in you and then mess with the meds some more and see what happens. I don't think it's going to do anything, but if you want to try it, we will. So I did, because why not? They had told me that after transplant, average lifespan was 10 years. I was 31. I was looking at 41. I was like, no, I'm not interested in that. Thank you. I'd like to have more than that if possible. I had to face mortality in a way that made me grasp life deeper. At one point, I broke my ankle, and I had to go off the list for a couple months, so I went to California to be with my uncle, and I went out in the Pacific Ocean while I was on the transplant list, right? Because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to live each day like it really was the last, because I didn't know. It was a wake-up, and it also taught me something else, because I had to spend a lot of time alone, and I had been busy all those years, right? Fit yourself to be of maximum service to God and fellows. And I was not necessarily fitting myself, but I was definitely being of service in any way and every way I could. I said yes to everything, even when I shouldn't. Because I was running from feelings. I was running from those pesky feelings I didn't want to feel. So I had to be alone. And I had to sit in silence sometimes. And learn how to be, just be, not do anymore, because I had limitations. I had to learn about limitations. I did not like that shit at all. I still don't, but I've had to learn how to live within them so that I can fit myself to be of maximum service. That fitting myself is the important part. Sometimes that means a nap, because I can't transmit something I haven't got. If I don't have it, I can't give it to you. And I want to give these things to people. After 18 months on the heart transplant list, that thing that they did, it worked. It worked. And usually you only die or get a transplant to come off that list. I'm so amazingly grateful for that. And my heart looks, I just had an echo the other day, and it was as normal as it's going to be. I have the pacemaker, right? So I got metal, you know? I got metal, and that's all right. They just replaced it a couple of years ago. It's like a little computer. It does all kinds of things. I have a transmitter at home that, like, sends them information every night. Like, it's crazy, like, cool. Where, I mean, I wish I didn't have to do it, but if I have to, at least there's really neat medical knowledge out there. That was such a hard time. And I stopped being able to go to as many meetings, so it was hard. When I would go to meetings, every time I would go around people, I would get sick because my immune system was so damaged at the time that I couldn't be around people much. So I really did have to learn how to get comfortable in my own skin. And that was the blessing of that. I don't necessarily wish that it happened again, but I definitely want to take the lessons that came from it.
couple years later, my older sister, who had been sober that time, she drifted in and out, but she'd been sober 4 or 5 years. She overdosed. And she left 3 girls and a baby, grandchild. And so as much fun as this is, and as much fun as this weekend has been, and it has been wild and crazy and fun, and I'm wondering why I didn't stick with Wi-Fi all that time. Like, why did I drift away? I don't know. I'm going to have to remedy that. And I'm glad about that. I'm grateful for that. We have a deadly disease, and it will kill you. It will kill you. It killed her. And when y'all took the moment and we said the names, was the first time I cried tonight. And when we said the names of the people we had lost, I've never seen that done. It's beautiful and wonderful and horrible all at the same time. So is the introduction. I have to tell you that I was so scared coming up here and hearing all the "we love you," and I still have a hard time receiving. I'm not as good at, I like to give. I don't want to receive. My sponsor tells me that I'm selfish, because if I only ever give, I'm not giving other people a chance to give. I need to receive. The week before my wedding, she gave me an assignment. She's like, okay, every day you're going to go find somebody new and get them to help you with something. And it has to be a different person every day. That was the worst assignment I ever got. I hate that assignment. I did. I hated that assignment. So going back to my wedding, we wanted to have a big wedding. We wanted to have a dance, to have the first dance. That's what I wanted. And my husband was the first dance, because that's where we started. And we went dancing like almost every weekend. So I wanted that moment. But to do that, I had to have dinner. And we couldn't afford that. So my mom was a caterer. And I kept thinking about it. And I was like, well, maybe I should ask her. But I didn't want to ask her to work on the day her daughter got married. Well, so finally I pony up and I ask her. And she's like, well, yeah, of course. I've been waiting for you to ask me. And that was the moment I realized that my mom gave me everything she had. If she had it to give me, she would. And if she didn't, she couldn't. And that was the first moment of forgiveness and peace that I felt in my heart with my mother. You know, I had gone no contact the first couple of years that I got sober, because I couldn't be around her. It made too many memories come up. But I had gotten to a point where I realized that she did love me in any way that she could. You know, now we speak weekly. I talk to my mom every week. And now, if I don't call her in enough time, she calls me. And that's different, because she's not the type to, she is definitely not the, she's the mind your own business kind. So if I don't volunteer something, she's not going to ask. But she will call me now. A few years ago, she got in a bad situation in a marriage and needed a place to go. She came and lived with us. And it was the most amazing experience, because I got to be with her as an adult, and I got to let her see who I was as an adult, because I hadn't spent any time with her really as an adult. And I got to really be with her. And we watched movies and we hang out and we went places and did things and laughed. And there was so much peace in that. You know, right after the medical stuff started and the heart stuff started, you know, I had to quit work, and we were in financial trouble. Now, over the promises, the fear of financial insecurity will leave us. That one is hard. I do not have that leave me very often, but that was an occasion where I was suddenly like, you know what? Okay, we were 2 days from being having our house put on auction, and somehow it got refinanced. But I was already had boxes. We had looked at places to move. I was not freaking out. Like, sometimes even the hardest promises come true. Sometimes they do. the reason that, you know, I can get up here and that I think experience is so important is because of the promise that says we will not shut the door on the past, or we will not regret the past and wish to shut the door on it. And that's why I share what I do. Because I don't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it anymore. Not anymore. Okay, so I don't know how the steps work. I know they do because I work them or live them now. I know they work, but sometimes I don't understand. I don't get it, but I don't need to. But I had a situation. My aunt. Okay, so we got into it. A lot of F-bombs were flying. It was over text too. It wasn't even in person. It's over text. She said some nasty things to me. Apparently, she was drunk. Whatever. I was itching for a fight, and I was like, I don't know, 13, 14, 15 years sober. I'm not well yet, right? I was itching for a fight anyway. I was in a bad mood. I was like, you know what? Screw this. F you. Whatever. Then I stopped and I was like, oh, crap. But I was so mad. The problem was my grandmother lived with her and she had leukemia. And so I was going to have to make peace with this woman. And I only had a few weeks to do it. And I'm like, this is not going to, how are the steps going to make me not hate this woman? Because I hated her at that moment. I hated her. And I didn't know how it was going to work. But I did it anyway. And somehow it worked. And in 6 and 7, where the magic really, really happens, where I get to give my higher power all of me and give back whatever they think I should have. That's where the magic happens, and that hatred was removed from me. And that doesn't always happen, and I'm really grateful that it did. I wish that more things would get removed just like magically like that, but I will take it. And I was able to go. I was able to be present. I was able to be in that woman's house. I made amends to her knowing that there would be no return. I knew that there would be no, you know, I had to look at myself longer. I could not have to disregard her entirely. So I was able to show up in such a way that a couple of years later, that woman and my mother asked me to officiate my grandmother's funeral. Instead of that, my grandmother hadn't found a pastor that she really liked in the area, so they asked me to do it, to actually officiate the funeral. And that was a blessing. That was a blessing. I never imagined that. Never imagined that I would officiate my grandmother's funeral, and it was beautiful. There are so many things, there's so many blessings, community, not wanting to change who I am anymore, not wanting to run away from the feelings of all the time, just sometimes. So I'm going to talk about my dogs now because I can. a few years over, we got our first dog, and I can't have kids because of health problems and other things. And anyway, I got dogs, and I started volunteering at rescue, and that became a way of service. And we have 3 dogs currently. When I called my husband today, I was like, how are my babies? I didn't ask him, how are you doing yet? Like, first it was, how are my babies? They taught me about unconditional love because they are always happy to see me. They don't care when I screw up, and I do. They just love. And rescue, learning how to work in that environment was challenging. And still is when I get the, you know, ability. I still have a lot of health problems, so I don't get to do as much as I would like to sometimes. I still get sick a lot when I go around people, but you know, sometimes you gotta do it. I had to come here, I had to be here, and I had to experience this. I needed to receive this. The friends that you make are lifelong friends, or they can be. They can be lifelong friends. These people that you're sitting next to, that are the ones in the back that you don't know, you never know.
where a connection may be made, or where similarity lies, looking for those similarities, not the differences, learning how to do that, because not everybody's experience will be the same. I'm thinking about, I have a few more minutes, what else I want to tell you, or not what I want to tell you, but what needs to be said. You know, all last night I didn't sleep because I was thinking of all the things I could possibly say. And now I'm like, like I could normally have talked for hours, but the energy here has been amazing. I really literally did not sleep last night because I could not calm down from all the excitement, from all the love. I saw in this place acceptance in a way that I don't always see it in the world. I saw people of all different kinds and shapes and sizes and colors and whatever, like all different kinds of people and all of them coming together for a single purpose. All for a single purpose. We're here to help others recover. And we can do that with our experience. We're willing to share it. You know, the first girlhood I sponsored, I was in the coffee bar, you know, after the meeting, and I saw her sitting there alone, and I'm like, oh, God, I have to go talk to her. Okay, I've got to go talk to her. This is how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to, okay, go talk to her. And I did, and it was so uncomfortable. But she was more uncomfortable than I was, and I made her feel more comfortable. You know, I get the privilege of so many people in my life. A couple of weeks ago, a woman that I sponsored 20 years ago wrote me and said, hey, I'm in rehab again, but I want to do this again. You know, and that was 20 years ago, but she's trying again. A couple of days ago, emailed a former sponsee because I have a current sponsee who needed some information that she had. And I haven't talked to her in a couple of years. She got back to me within 10 minutes and had the information I needed. And was like, hey, how are you doing? Hey, how are you doing? Lifelong connections. Nothing will ensure immunity from a drink so much as intensive work with other alcoholics. So when I, my sponsees may or may not know this, but when I get where I feel a little itchy or weird or I'm having feelings, sometimes I'll check on them to get out of myself, and they think it's me being nice. You know, I might have control. I won't have her now because sooner or later they're going to hear this, but whatever. So they'll know, so they can do it too, so they can get out of themselves, because that's what a lot of this is, just getting out of myself, clearing out the channel enough so that I can listen to that small, still voice that tells me what to do. The intuition that I was promised in the 9-step promises that I would know how to handle situations was used to baffle us. That God would do for me what I could not do for myself. You know, I was taught when I got sober that I'd lost the power of choice in drink. If I was given the opportunity, I would drink. I didn't have a choice about that. I had lost that choice. The choice I had was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, or to accept spiritual help. Every single thing I do, and every day I think of that as my choice. Am I going to go on to the bitter end? And sometimes I think I will. Or am I going to accept spiritual help? Today I prayed, obviously, I've made it through this. I didn't puke. I didn't pass out, and I didn't fall in heels, which is fantastic, right? And I didn't die. There you go. When I was first sober, I thought about, you know, all of that. I wanted to be 20 years sober when you're sober. I said I wanted to be, because I was going to be the best AA that ever AA'd. So I wanted to be 20 years sober, and I wasn't. But I had this picture of someday getting to do something like this. I never really thought it would be the real, I mean, really, you speak at a conference? What? Like, that's impossible, but it isn't impossible. There's nothing too good for a sober alcoholic. Woo! They used to say that where I came from. There's nothing too good for a sober alcoholic. And we can do anything. We can do anything. And when Danielle asked me for a speaker tape a few months ago, I was like, a speaker tape? Why would I have that? I mean, I've told my story dozens of times, but I haven't ever spoke like anywhere like this. So, but I thought it was a good idea at the time. Today, I wasn't so sure. Tonight, I am sure. Tonight, I am sure it was the best idea. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to have my dream come true. Yeah. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous.